Hello and welcome to episode 325 of the ZA Tech Show for Tuesday, the 14th of April, 2015. Don't give me hell, people. Everybody's been on Easter holidays and Pesach and all kinds of interesting bits of leave. So we haven't managed to put a podcast out in the past week or so. But nonetheless, the excuse I'm going to use is that I was waiting for a man to come back from a cave in the Far East. That man is Mr. Andy Hadfield from... Where are you from at the moment? You're from a variety of different places, including most notably For Good, but are you still from andyhadfield.com?
It's there, doing things. Hello, Brett.
How are you doing, sir?
Yeah, we can punt For Good. That's all good.
It's all good to punt For Good.
It's all good to punt For Good. Forgood.co.za. I'll try to say it a bunch of times.
There you go. We'll see how we can rope it in. So you were in a cave.
I survived.
Where exactly was said cave? The biggest cave in the world or something like that,
so it's
right?
A cave called Hang Son Dong. Hang wow. means cave in Vietnamese. And it's recently been declared the largest cave in the world.
Wow.
So it's so big you can fly a 747 through it.
Jeez. Well, it, you know, assuming you could get the 747 into it and out the other side again, right?
Which you can't.
But inside, you could fit a 747.
If you could teleport a 747 in there, it would work.
And then fly it around and then teleport it out again.
Correct.
See, everybody was questioning the fact that we were going to manage to get tech into this cave story somehow.
Oh, no. I actually thought of a much better way to get tech in. One of the best things that ZA Tech Show listeners need to go and Google right now is a guy called Ryan DeBoort.
Okay.
And he took a Phantom 2 drone.
Oh, yeah.
And he flew it in and out and on top of Son Dong.
While you were there?
No. It was the trip a couple before us.
Okay.
And it is some of the most intense footage you will ever see.
I love the fact that drones are playing such a big role in what we're seeing in terms of media on the net at the moment. There's like every two or three days I'm seeing an awesome drone video or some awesome pics taken by a drone. And of course, I mean, we'll get to this a little bit later, but of course, there's been a firming up of the legislation in terms of what drones are and aren't allowed to do recently passed in the
There
US.
Has to be, because they're essentially dodgy.
Absolutely.
Can be used. In fact, I was hearing a story from someone
on the
trip.
The FBI can hack them and the CIA can hack them. They can hack them.
But in Australia, apparently, they are selling, now this is complete hearsay, but they're selling some kind of device.
This may or may not be true.
This is from people I was in a cave drinking rice wine with, so you take that with a pinch of salt.
And they were from Australia, I take it.
From Australia.
Okay. So I don't believe a word he says right now.
There's this device that you can, it's an electric device you can plug in, and especially if you live in a big block of flats, what it does is interrupt drone signals.
Wow.
Because what's happening is people are flying these drones up big blocks of flats to spy in the windows.
Oh, and then it's like a modified Wi-Fi thing, and then what happens is the drone just prangs into something, like random.
I don't exactly know what it does.
Like a three-year-old child or a cat, right?
I can tell you, though, that the people
next
I was...
Next big thing, cat videos, drones flying into cats. Seriously, this is going to be the next big thing. Watch.
So the people I was traveling with,
cats flying drones into people.
Doesn't work. We watched the Ryan DeBoort's drone photography of Son Dong, and they were inspired to actually buy one. So they went Hong Kong... duty-free before we arrived and bought a Phantom 2.
They're apparently like 10 kinds of awesome, hey?
They are really hard to fly.
I'm sure most drones take a lot of time to actually get used to.
I mean, it took us 20 to 30 minutes just to calibrate the thing. There's quite an intensive calibration process.
Yes.
Because you have to get the gyros.
I take it this is not one that you actually fly from your iPhone, right?
No, it's quite cool. So they have a proper remote control, but then your iPhone clips in the top.
Oh, for the visual.
For the vision.
Oh, man, that's super
cool. And then
the
camera's on a gimbal, so the camera's dead straight, even if you're wobbling around.
It's like it's stabilized. It's
full
amazing.
1080p, 60 frames per second. But we got it to go up and we got it to go down, and then the battery ran out.
Okay. It ran out when it was down, not while on the way down.
We landed it.
Okay.
Was good.
Very good.
The cave was amazing. It was probably the most physically demanding thing I've ever done in my entire life. But and it's hard to describe. I released a couple of pictures on Instagram, and I'll do a post. Because we were the first South Africans through Son Dong, officially.
Wow. Very cool. So no... No LTE, no Wi-Fi, no...
Dude, I turned on Strava on day one, because day one's quite hectic from a climbing... You're dropping a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And so none of them had got a GPS kind of track of day one, and you're outside most of day one.
Sure.
39 degrees, hiking through the, you know, full metal jacket jungle.
Jeez,
and there wasn't even GPS there.
Wow,
there's just nothing. You do come across bombshells in the jungle.
Wow, seriously.
Yeah. It's one of the crazy things we learned about Vietnam is during the war. I mean, A, the Vietnamese are really proud that they won it, whatever America wants you to believe. But during the war, they dropped 1,000 tons of bombs per person into Vietnam.
So I heard, yeah.
And this particular area where the national park is, where this cave is, it was just carpeted with bombs. The growth you see there is post-war growth. So you regularly come across bombs in the jungle.
Like, but there's nothing live left there.
There's a lot of live bombs.
Ooh.
A lot of people make money going to recover ordnance. I wanted to say that word.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose it's the same as Angola, Mozambique, et cetera, et cetera. There's still a lot of buried ordnance. See, I managed to get it in there too. And it's interesting, complete sidetrack and complete rat hole here, but they use rats, you know, there's like highly trained rats that can apparently sniff out what's happening. Yeah. So what I'm
showing you for our audio listeners is just a time lapse I took.
I saw this. It's actually beautiful. Go I check out Andy's
Twitter feed. I'll post something on the blog.
At Andy Hadfield. Very difficult to
get it wrong. Yeah. Hadfield. Yeah. But yeah, it was a cheese man. I'm not a religious person, but it felt like the universe was pointing at me.
That's awesome.
It was pretty cool.
Awesome, dude. Awesome, awesome. So yeah, we...
Drones and caves, done.
Indeed. We must actually get together and do a photo night or something like that. You know, drink some wine. I hate drinking wine. It's terrible. Anyway, so speaking about cool gadgets and stuff like that, we've been inundated with a bunch of gadgets at the office this week. We've received Galaxy S6, Galaxy S6 Edge, which thankfully they were 3 or 4 days apart, which means I actually got a chance to play with a Galaxy S6 because... Andy, you had a feel of both of these devices this afternoon, and I would have found it unbelievably difficult to have paid any attention to the S6 if the S6 Edge had arrived at exactly the same time, because I really think that curved screen's really, really pretty. And what were your impressions of it? You played with it for a couple of minutes. Do you think it's gimmicky? Do you think it feels interesting? Or?
No, I think Samsung's pretty much on par with Apple in terms of build quality.
It's like they've been lagging behind for the longest time, and now suddenly the device feels classy and solid and inspires confidence, right?
The S4 felt a bit plasticky.
Yeah,
and the S3 as well. And you could clip off the plastic cover off the back and change it and all that kind of stuff. They've also got an integrated battery, haven't they?
Yes, so integrated battery. Very important thing as well that I think is actually quite a drawback, but a lot of people are seeing it as not a problem, is it's one of the few Android devices that lacks a micro SD card slot. So
how much that's used?
Speaking from like personal experience and my own mileage, I mean, your mileage may vary, but for me, that's the thing I appreciate most about Android devices, is the fact that I don't care what the base storage is, because you just jam a really big micro SD into the side.
But there are complications. I mean, you can't run a lot of apps on the SD.
It's not about apps. It's about storage. This is about putting music, pictures, video, all of that kind of stuff. And I mean, the SDs are super, super quick now, so that's not a problem. To that end, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how the market responds to the different price points. But you've got a distinct 16, 32 gig, 64 gig, and 128 gig model. Sorry, I don't know whether there's a 16 or not. So I've received a 32 gig. We've also received a 64 gig in the office, and then one 128 gig of the Edge. So there are distinct breaks in terms of capacity, and the pricing is obviously adjustable according to that. But personally, I would have way preferred to have gotten like a one with a smaller capacity, and had a micro SD to fall back on. It's the thing that irritates me about the whole iPhone thing, is you've got to buy so high in terms of capacity in order to be satisfied. It's like you can't survive without 64 gigs now. My personal opinion. It's really tough.
I think you're on the upper end of usage.
No, I mean, a lot of the time I'm just deleting stuff. It's scary how much space time lapses take. And I mean, it's great that you've got this continuous shooting mode for cameras, but you've any idea how much space those photos take up on the
well, your average iPhone 6 photo is what, 4 to 6 megs a photo?
There we go. I mean, I ran out of capacity on a 16 gig, which I was testing at the Foo Fighters concert recently. It's like it ran out of juice. So, and I think it had like 8 or 9 gigs available when I went into the thing.
Sure.
So,
So anyway, so that's been quite interesting to see those two devices, and I actually think that the S6 Edge is going to be really interesting.
So price? I mean, I did see a lot of the jokes around the fact that Apple is no longer the most expensive
smartphone. It is definitely not cheap at all. I think you're looking at up to about 16.5 grand cash for some of these devices. It's really
that's more expensive than a Mac Air.
But, dude, in a lot of ways, as functional, it's quite a thing.
Sure.
So the you're looking at anywhere between like early 12s to mid 16s, depending on where you get it and stuff like that. The 32 gigs a version of the S6 is like 12.5. So that's heavy. It is a lot of money. But I mean, Apple's not completely blameless in all of that. I mean, the high-end iPhone 6 Pluses are also like bloody expensive.
Yeah, but it's Apple. You kind of expect, you know, that's Apple tax.
No, but at the same time, I think that this is as good a device. The screen is astounding. It felt like it was a dummy phone that I had to peel the plastic off of it because it's so crisp and sharp. So.
Well, maybe that's the pricing strategy, as Samsung said. Well, you know, we believe that we don't necessarily have an inferior product, so why not cost it out at relatively the same as the iPhone 6?
And I mean, in a lot of ways, I think that the S3, S4, and S5 were as good as the Apple devices of the day in terms of hardware spec. I just felt the build quality wasn't up to scratch, and the software wasn't.
The OS, yeah.
It feels like it's suddenly fitting together now with the Samsung stuff. So it'll be interesting to see how the market responds, especially considering, like you say, the high price. As impressive as the S6 and the S6 Edge has been for me this week, another device that's come across my desk that I have been absolutely astounded with is the Hisense Infinity H6. Don't look at me like I'm mad. Yes, Hisense.
So they make cheap, crappy TVs, don't they?
No, actually, they make some really, really killer stuff now. It's just the brand, because it tended to aim at the more like cost-effective side of the market, kind of got labeled as a cheap brand. But, wow, let me tell you, there's an 85-inch TV that I saw in their showroom recently. It's 4K. It is astoundingly good. I mean, the picture is just fantastic. And I mean, that's 130,000 rands worth of TV, which is like half the price of competing brands in terms of 4K at that kind of size. And yeah, like runs full Android. So you've got the ability to, like, if you play with Plex at home, you have the ability to download the Plex app for it and stuff like that. But this phone has been particularly interesting to me because it's...
So this was this thin one you showed me just now.
Yeah, absolutely. The one that looks like an iPhone.
Older
absolutely.
iPhone.
So if you look at the iPhone 5...
It's like
5,
a bevel or a...
Yeah, they're like almost like shiny beveled edge around the top corner, and that flat kind of almost hockey puck vibe with the little plastic brakes in it where the chassis meets the screen and stuff like that. Very, very similar to that. In fact, modeled very, very closely on the iPhone, I think, in terms of look and feel. It's got a really, really nice screen. It's got a not too shabby quad-core Snapdragon processor in it. What I love about it, it's got dual SIM. So the nice thing with that is you buy yourself a cheap data bundle from one operator and you focus on voice and SMS from another. And it's 4,000 Rand. It is a really, really nice phone for like 4K. That's the Infinity H6. Yeah, so I was just absolutely astounded by that. That kind of quality and that kind of power in terms of a phone. Yeah. I mean, it's not a top-end phone by any stretch of the imagination, but the 90% of Android users are not going to notice any difference.
Yeah.
I think it's got a kind of mid-range Qualcomm Snapdragon processor in it. Quite cool.
In that price range, you don't need top of the range. Functionality. So, yeah, $10 down, bottle of wine down on the fact that Celsius going to snap that up and you're going to get this 99 Rand contract that comes with sort of 5
and a megs. Well, it's interesting. I mean, chatting to a lot of the vendors that are trying to make it into the market right now, it's actually quite tough getting operators interested. So I think Hisense, for example, is available in Cell C stores, but not currently on contract. It's only on prepaid. And I think, you know what, while it's a fantastic value proposition for a phone like that, it's like a four grand device. You look at it, you go, shit, what more do you want for $4,000? It really is a great value proposition. I think they sit in a really uncomfortable space. Because I don't know how many people pay cash for a phone that's upwards of 2,000 Rand.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the first thing.
I'd wonder the same thing.
And I would argue that if you're on contract, why are you going to get a phone that's under 8K? Because the length of time you're going to finance the thing over, it makes sense to get a higher-end phone that's kind of in the Apple and kind of Samsung range.
No, because then you're
I mean, Huawei, you've seen some of the new Huawei devices. Man, it's like amazingly good.
You're into $500-600 a month then. So what a phone like this could
do... What, an 8-grade...
$8,000
device.
Yeah. What a phone like this could do is allow it open up the bottom of the market for new contract customers. So a 99 Rand contract is going to be a lot easier from a FICA point of view, from a financial affordability point of view.
Sure.
And you could get a $4,000 Android device plus a gig of data and 10 minutes. I mean, who uses minutes anymore? So you could, that's what I'm thinking. Cell C, they're very price conscious. That's how they compete. A little 99 Rand contract with a whack of data and
interesting.
A phone like that.
Adam and Charlie did a story last week Friday that I kind of like stuck my head over their shoulder that I thought was kind of cool, was essentially looking at this new contract that Cell C's got where they've gone Soman on the voice side of things, but they've like beefed the hell out of the data contract. And it got me thinking also, it's like, do you think we're approaching a time where voice, honestly, you know, starts disappearing?
Voice in the way they're doing it
now. So the trend is showing that. And I mean, every single annual report you see coming out of the likes of MTN and Vodacom and stuff like that are showing declining voice revenues, increasing data revenues, or at least the proportion is shifting. But for me, I don't use less voice. I think if the networks had to enable voice over LTE and stuff like that and make that native, and it just all became data at the end of the day, then maybe. But do you see yourself using less voice now?
I use less voice. Already.
Okay.
If I look at my contracts, I get like 200 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
I have so many of those piled up.
Really?
But yet I burn my data almost instantly and have to top up.
Do you think it's a cultural thing that people are using less voice, so therefore the preferred mechanism for communication becomes database stuff?
It's also, I think there's a culture shift towards quicker.
It's not a cost-saving thing anymore.
No, I think partly it is. That's how it starts. Younger generation moving onto smartphones much earlier than we did. You know, I got my first
data being more accessible.
Data is more accessible, but I think there's, you know, A, the devices are getting into the market much younger, and B, there is a culture towards shorter communication. But, you know, the WhatsApp message, the Mixit message, SMS is pretty much dead. I think voice is dying quickly. What's happening with the WhatsApp voice trial?
I don't know. I have seen some stuff out there. I know some people that are testing it at the moment.
So it's a standard VoIP. It's an interesting move.
The ability to call straight out of WhatsApp, and apparently it brokers the VoIP call. It's
you know what's going to be interesting? Isn't WhatsApp free on Cell C?
Well,
they're going to change that tune very quickly.
Well, this is the thing. You know, I think when they announced that they were beginning to partner with certain operators and stuff like that and zero rating data, that's WhatsApp associated. It was a really interesting crossroads, because I think that to the point of sliding voice revenue and all of that kind of thing, it starts getting interesting in that I suspect WhatsApp is going to start charging for voice calls made from within WhatsApp, okay? So the data kind of stuff, because, I mean, you know, that kind of makes sense. And then what happens is the operator starts ending up in a position where they become the reseller of the WhatsApp credit to make the calling.
Oh, man, that's a tough call for an operator. You know,
and I look at it and I go, it's an interesting law reversal. But at the same time, I look at it and I go, wow, that's just so much smoke and mirrors. So what the operator's doing at the end of the day, they're keeping probably the lion's share of the revenue. They're probably keeping like 80 to 90% of the revenue because they've got a hard cost, which is the data cost, to negotiate. And WhatsApp's just creaming it on the top.
Sure.
And operators are forced to now start doing this because that's just how the model's going to work. It can't be free, though, Andy. It can't be free. I mean, Cell C long-term cannot give you unlimited WhatsApp voice calling.
No, Cell C can't. Okay, but Facebook owns WhatsApp, and if Facebook wanted to make a play to own your communication on all levels,
they are.
I could completely see them offering.
That is their play. Absolutely.
Yeah, but I could completely see them offering WhatsApp calling for free.
Sure. No, they would offer WhatsApp calling for free, but somebody's going to have to pay at some stage.
Well, then you would pay data to the network operators, but the network operators literally lose that last little bit of the cash cow, which is
voice. They have to carry all of the cost and get zero of the benefit.
Good place to be is Facebook. Bad place to be is
I don't know, man. I think there's some questions about Facebook too. It's like seeing Zuckerberg talk at Mobile World. It's really interesting to see how his internet.org stuff really hasn't gotten as much traction as what it seemed it was going to get. Unbelievably noble cause, everything else. Operators not happy. Not actually really ending up in intangible differences in ARPU, which is what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to get people online and get them using the internet and then create that fringe
that like silver lining to the cloud that means that people that previously weren't in a position to make use of anything now start paying for usage to other services. And as far as I'm aware, properly materialized. So interesting. Lots of us want to mention very, very briefly, and that's I haven't really had a chance to play with it very much, but I had probably about 15, 20 minutes with it. I can really only talk about the overall build quality of the device and how the interface felt. And that's the HTC One M9, which is, of course, the other big product to have been launched at Mobile World recently. We finally got it in South Africa. We're playing with it. It'll be available from the 1st of June. Really, really beautiful device. I mean, there hasn't been an HTC device in a while that I haven't really enjoyed playing with. I think the build quality has always been fantastic. The screens have been good. There's some questions around the camera, but we'll see. Apparently now it's running a full-blown version of the OS, where apparently it wasn't, there were some tweaks and bits and pieces missing at Mobile World when we played with it. But the bigger problem that HTC faces, and they remain convinced right now that this is not going to actually be a problem that's going to continue to haunt them, but they've always struggled to provide decent support, decent stock levels, and to actually get the right level of penetration into the networks. And as we know, that's largely dictated by the amount of marketing spend they've got. I mean, you must know how the networks play right. I mean, you know the story. So it's like if you want to sell Andy's cell phone, let's say you fly to China and you commission an OEM and they make a whole bunch of phones for you and you bring it back to South Africa and it could be the best phone ever, but you pitch it to the networks, they want a whole business case around that and they want to know how much marketing support you're going to create. So you've got to set aside marketing fund and give it to the network to market your product. And at the end of the day, if it doesn't work and it doesn't sell, they just give you all your stock back and tell you to sod off. So HEC struggled to have the level of money and, you know, to do that. And they're every year they're spending a bit more on marketing and they're working a little bit harder. So, you know, I do hope that they succeed because they've got great product. It's just they just don't seem to get there at the end of the day.
That's why I'd back Facebook any day, because I think operators have... they're big, hulking, ugly monopolies, and
sure. They've
been the schoolyard bully for quite a while, and it's nice for someone to kind of hit back.
It's a lot of power in those networks, though. Believe me, it's still there. And I think the further up you go into Africa, the more and more power the networks actually wield at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's interesting about these devices, though. I mean, it feels like the premium smartphone market has just matured. You've got a very...
It's unbelievably difficult making a choice at the top end of the market right now, especially with the new Samsung devices. I mean, for me, there was very much in terms of look and feel a clear leader a couple of months ago. That, for me, was Sony. All right, Sony's Android devices I have been in love with for 2 years now because they just feel really, really... You know, that typically good Sony feel. It just feels like a solid device that will just... It'll be reliable, it'll do what it says on the box, and all of that kind of thing. And then, on top of that,
and
great...
And you can play with the PlayStation remote.
Yeah, but I mean, great battery life, waterproof, killer camera. I mean, these are important things, especially when a phone becomes so much more an intrinsic part of your life, right?
So there was one in the cave.
Yeah, totally. I can totally believe it.
Completely waterproof in the underground rivers. Bang, bang, bang.
Yeah, and killer camera on it, right? Great low light conditions, etc. So that was the clear leader for me for a long time, and I loved the approach that they took to Android as well, not putting too much crud in the OS. And then HTC's always had a great product, but it seemed to lag behind just from an availability and a support and a limelight perspective. Huawei, rising star, producing great products, punching above their weight, been really, really impressive. And then Samsung being the biggest player on the block, but not necessarily making the best product. Okay, I think that Mobile World, a lot of that stuff changed. It's like Samsung's right back in the limelight because not only are they the biggest player in this space right now, but they're making an absolutely killer product. I wouldn't want to be Sony to have to compete with that right now because they've been gaining, I think, a lot of traction and a lot of ground on account of the fact that their product is really, really good. So Samsung's closed the door on them there. So it's going to be really interesting. But it's tough. I mean, you know, I can't tell you. And this is my job. I'm supposed to know. All right. And it's between three devices for me right now. That S6 Edge is astoundingly good. The Z3 Compact from Sony remains an amazing product because it's as powerful and as awesome as the Z3. It's just smaller screen, better battery life. And then the HTC One M9, beautiful, beautiful device. I mean, and notice, it's really interesting, there's not an iPhone in that list.
No, look, I mean, I'd still stick iPhone in there, but I think the choice is probably down to ecosystem now. You know, I'm vested in the Microsoft the Apple ecosystem.
Sure.
So to switch to Android is very hard.
No, sure.
You know, especially when you've got the Mac, you've got iTunes Match, you've got a couple of services. It makes it really, really hard to switch to Android. So sure. I think the marketing of the future around these devices is going to be exit points. So how to block exit points. And sure. An exit point would be a service that works really badly and gets me frustrated enough to think of a viable alternative. Like iTunes Match in its beginning, like iCloud in the beginning.
Well, you know what?
I think a lot of people dropped when those services weren't as great as they should have been.
Well, with the latest version of Android, there's actually been an amazing exit point introduced, which I'm still trying to figure out. I can't see why they've invented this other than to make life astoundingly simple for tech reviewers. But there's a feature...
I'm sure they're building global functions for you guys.
Hear me out. Listen to this. I mean, So switching from my Z3 Compact to the Galaxy S6 was an absolute cinch because the new version of Android's got a feature built in where you pair the two devices, you tap them against each other using NFC, opens up a Bluetooth connection, and takes all of the content, your email accounts, everything, and just blasts it from the one device to the other device using Bluetooth. And suddenly you pick the new device up, and all your preferences, everything is identical. It's set up and it's ready to go. Okay. Now, that's fantastic, all right? But the amount of work that went into creating a feature that realistically, for the average user, is going to be used maybe once a year, if you think about it. I mean, so most users, it's now shown they are not waiting 24 months. What they're doing is they're buying a device every 12 months, and then the next device they buy will be on their contract, and the next device they'll buy, and the next device will be on a contract.
Premium users, obviously.
Premium users, but
that's a lot users, of money.
The users of that category of phone are on average upgrading on an annual basis. People are not waiting two years.
That's insane, man. Because at $10,000 a device, you're almost at $1,000 a month.
But remember, there's great on sale potential right now. So you can sell an iPhone 5S on the secondhand market for about $4,000-$4,500. It's a device that I think cost about $9,000 or $10,000 a year or so ago. So I mean, yes, massive depreciation, 50% to 60% depreciation in the space of a year, but still. It's not bad, right? It's not a completely worthless device. Because a lot of people are looking at playing with the iOS for the first time or Android for the first time or whatever. And those are still absolutely capable devices. But that feature was a game changer for me. The fact that you make sure NFC is enabled on both the devices, you tap them together and you say, okay, suck all the data from the old phone, sucks it across. No connecting to anything, no connecting to a computer, no special anything. It's just like, bam, authorize and go.
Layman's question, do you have to actually tap to get NFC to work?
Yes. Well,
that seems pretty silly.
No, it's not. Because
why do you tap to activate the chip?
Well, it's proximity.
So you could put them really close together. Do you have to actually tap?
Yeah, absolutely. You could put them really close together, but I think that realistically you're likely to tap it rather than get it. I mean, hey, if you want to get it really close.
I wouldn't tap this thing anyway.
I don't know. So for me, get it really close and go as opposed to tap and go. It doesn't ring off the tongue just as easily. I mean, if you were in marketing, would you have we're launching our new get it really close and go to pay. Tap
sounds
and
like
go,
a good,
tap and go for,
anyway. Good spoof video.
So, but nonetheless, I think it that was an astoundingly cool feature. And finally, we have a use for NFC. Yay! Because payments is not going to work. People still maintain payment is not going to be the thing. Anywho, so that was a really, really interesting feature built into Android. I can't see. I mean, can you see that being used for anything else? But making technology reviewers' lives easier.
I mean, isn't it swapping to your next Android device? That's the big thing.
Yes, but why would you go to all of that effort for something you're going to use once for 30 seconds once a year?
I would like to know how much time Microsoft spent on that, that thing to transfer files between Windows machines. That was a nightmare.
And it still doesn't work, okay?
Yeah.
It still leaves half the crap behind.
I don't know.
Whereas I'm just going to say this again, just to allay any fears of me becoming a Android sympathizer in place of being an Apple fanboy. I'm still a huge Apple fanboy. I'm just going to say that Macs have been doing this since 15 years now. You've been able to plug one Mac into another Mac and they just...
You would think now that it was just a username and password, and everything was pretty much stored on the cloud.
Well, no, it is. I mean, this is the amazing
thing.
Just
photos, I think, and even
no,
photos
well, PhotoStream. You don't need. People really exaggerate the need to do backup. Now, I just push everything to the sync everything to the cloud, and you never need to do a backup.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's quickly speak about Apple Watch, because there's been a bunch of reviews that have surfaced, and we've all been waiting in eager anticipation of it. I think everybody was expecting the reviews to be overwhelmingly positive.
As and they always are.
I think apart from the New York Times review, where the guy sounded like he'd actually been paid by Apple.
David Pogue's not there anymore, is he?
No, he isn't. But
it's
wow.
It's sold out.
And everybody's hating on it. Everybody that's got, well, not everybody, but I think the vast majority of the press that matters is hating on it. Because
so reasons why?
Battery life, terrible.
How much?
Okay. Well, terrible. Like, I mean, like 3-4 hours in some cases.
What? Right?
Yes, you can absolutely stretch it to like a 12-13 hour day if you don't use it ever. And leave it like you know, bury it under a bushel, you know. So, I mean, you know, that's one major, major drawback. I think a lot of people are still trying to figure out the interface, because it's a lot more complex than what iOS normally is to negotiate.
Just looking at it looks complex, those little circular icons.
The things that people are loving on, and I must say this is quite intriguing. I am looking forward to actually playing one just to have this, is the that haptic engine that's got, you know, that is
the little haptic feedback.
No, but the different buzzes depending on what kind of notification it's providing you with. And this is where Apple's genius really does actually shine through, because they understand that UX is more than visual. All right. And so depending on whether you've got an email or there's a call incoming, or you've got an SMS or a social media alert, or you have an alarm that you've set, or whatever the case is, the little buzz is different.
Mm.
They've done it so subtly that it's a slow kind of like hummingbird type vibe. Other cases, it's like really, really sharp and like, you know, quite jarring. So overwhelmingly, the feedback is that that is a really, really cool feature.
So I'm just looking at The Verge's. They have this massive review on the Apple Watch.
Well, they always go unbelievably detailed with this.
It's really nice. It's very pretty. And they've split it into parts of the day. And the day starts at 7:36 a.m. And the first icon in here is the battery.
Yeah.
100% at 7:36 a.m. And I'll tell you what it gets to. Wait for the internet to load. So I think the guy kind of puts it on and then leaves the house, and the internet is really slow here. 95%.
Okay, so what I'll fill you in on is, no surprise, the most popular Apple Watch so far is the 42mm Sport.
Yeah, the black band. Yeah, I would imagine that would be it.
So the simple.
Can you shower with it?
No.
See, that worries me. You know, I've been jonesing on your Fitbit Charge HR.
And yeah, we'll get to that in a sec. But you can't shower with...
You can't shower with the Apple Watch.
Not as far as I'm aware. It's it's not designed for that kind of use. This is what a lot of people aren't actually considering when they design their wearables right now. And I think there's some fatal flaws associated with all of that. Because look at all of the cool fitness features, and it can do interesting stuff using my heart rate, and it can track this and it can track that, all right?
But sweat on it and it breaks.
Yes, absolutely. At high heart rate, the body does something really interesting, right? It gets wet, okay? The device tracking your heart rate will therefore, by association, also get wet. So, I mean, it's designed to withstand a splash and stuff like that, and it'll work fine under the circumstances exercise and whatever the case is, like everyday usage, but you are rather discouraged from showering with a Fitbit Charge HR on it. So,
well, the last thing about
again,
Apple
I
Watch.
Might be showing myself up, but I haven't seen anybody talking particularly about showering with their Apple Watch.
So on the 6:24 p.m. on the Verge review, and they're down to 25%. So
yeah, I see.
That seems like they got it through a day, though.
Yeah, but I think that they actively try to. You know, again, you would expect the usage to be much lower if you are using the built-in GPS and sport features and stuff like that, like extensively. Mm. I've seen that again with something like the Charge HR, which has got the built-in heart rate monitor. And to be clear, this is a completely different category of device.
Yeah.
The Charge HR is just a fitness tracker. The Apple Watch is a full-blown wearable with like amazing awesomeness and blah 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 blah. But the point is, there's a lot more things talking to that kind of device and whatever the case is. When
there's internet,
the Charge HR is in full heart rate mode, flat out all the time, because that's the other thing. It says it's got 24-hour monitoring. It's got the capability to do 24-hour monitoring.
Well, it does it once an hour, I think.
It checks in and checks out, and it also has this ability to know when you're hitting a period of high heart rate, and then it switches on its ability to 24-hour track. So that's quite interesting. And, of course, you can activate it by tapping it or whatever. But to be clear, it's not 24-hour tracking. If you have it in 24-hour tracking mode, it's going to chow the battery. Mm. In fact, I'd be surprised if you'd get through a day.
Sure. See, I've got to say that the fitness devices, and you know, whether you're a fitness person or an active person or not is irregardless. I just find them a little more accessible, I think, than an Apple Watch. So they're vastly cheaper. And I have to say, since
but they do not do the same thing.
No, they don't do the same thing. But you know, since we bought that Nike Fuel back in South by Southwest 2012,
were we with those? I mean, it was like
first South Africans.
Absolutely.
Number of firsts.
I remember it was the most amazing thing. It's like, because remember, it was after Jobs' death.
Mm.
Remember, so Jobs had died, and like 6 months later. And I remember being out for supper one night with a bunch of people in Austin, and we just gotten our Fuel Bands. And this dude had also, it was some dude from a design agency.
It was prior to us getting the Fuel Bands. It was the reason we went to get.
Oh yes, I loved this story. It was amazing. And he was a designer, and he said, "Oh, you have to go get the Fuel Band." And I was like, "Why?" And he said, "You know what? When Steve Jobs died, I got really, really sad because I felt like all of the goodness in the world had left. And then I saw the Nike Fuel Band and how good the UX was, and I was like, okay, it's all gonna be all right.
The universe makes sense again. Yeah,
somebody gave a crap about UX. And I mean, still today, I believe that the UX of the Fuel Band is still revolutionary. Yeah. It's beautiful by comparison to a lot of the devices out there. But
ever since I put that device on, I have really enjoyed having a very simple fitness tracker on me at all times.
I think it's a fine line, hey, between catering for, and I mean, we as people have changed in terms of our demands on these devices. We've become more, and it's interesting, is it as a result of seeing all of the fitness tracking stuff that we become a little bit more cognizant of the metrics, or have we just naturally become fitter people anyway?
I think there's a global cultural shift towards healthiness.
But I think that there's definitely that fine line. It's like my needs are probably a lot more demanding than the average person, but I think I still also seek simplicity. I hear what you're saying about the simplicity angle. I want the device to be slightly more intuitive. I want it to know what I'm doing at that point in time. I don't want to have to say to it, "I am now cycling, dear device," or I am cycling on an indoor trainer device. It should know that when it's like been tracking me for 2 minutes and I've been exerting myself like mad in a cycling tough fashion and not moved. All right, bam, you know. And this is the thing that also, I mean, you know, that I think there's so much work to be done here, not just on the devices, but on the ecosystems. Again, Fitbit is a clear example, right? I'm immediately disadvantaged by the fact that I cycle most of the time, right? And I swim the rest of the time. The running and walking bit of my fitness regime is unbelievably low. And because I do so much exercise, I actually, ironically enough, don't find the need to go out for like a long neighborhood walk in order to get my steps
up. Look, mountain biking works fine with a Fitbit. It just goes into sleep mode. Mine goes into sleep mode when I clap.
The point I'm making is it was very rare. I had this ride on Sunday that it logged a ton of steps for like the 3-hour ride I did. But for most of my indoor work and stuff, it's flat. It's dead.
Again, remember how young this industry is.
Gazillions of freaking calories, and I get 0 points for it. And some dude that walked around the block ends up trumping me in the weekly competition, you know?
The quantified self is a really immature industry, and they're starting with the most easily accessible sports, which is walking and running. That's the only reason.
Cycling is the new golf, dude.
Yeah, but you got to look at global trends. There are more people that run and walk than have a mountain bike. I can guarantee you that.
Okay, let me change the subject completely and speak about another global trend, one that is in the opposite end of the scale of all of the fitness and everything we're talking about. But Game of Thrones.
No freaking spoilers, please.
You've not seen it yet.
No, we've had this debate before. I cannot watch things once a week.
There is an exception to that rule, and that is Game of Thrones.
No, I'm no longer pregnant.
You are going to lose unless you cancel your DSL subscription if I'm not looking at another social network for the next,
No, but I've read 18 books. I know what goes on.
Anyway.
I am spoiling that whole series, and then I will binge watch it in a week.
So did you see the first four episodes?
Yes, actually.
Oops.
Oh, do you think that was leaked?
No. So here's the thing: they've actually traced it back. It's a journal copy. It was sent to a journal, and he ripped it and put it on the internet. And then, mysteriously, he's now in trouble because his episodes leaked onto the internet. It's like, you sign a contract normally to say that you will not leak the stuff or allow it. You are personally then responsible, and I'm pretty sure there's going to be some damages associated with it. But
while secretly they're delighted that the whole world is.
HBO has said 3 days after an episode ships, they're done with it. The world can have it. I mean, really, really interesting.
Except they don't give away to the world.
No, but they expect the world to make it so. And in making it so, the first four episodes had been downloaded 1.5 million times in the first 24 hours. That's astounding. I mean, just calculate the bandwidth, considering the fact that no self-respecting human would watch this in anything under 720p. I mean,
this is about what a kick in the episode.
Yeah, you need high-def boobs. That's simple, right? So 720p.
Excellent. There's boobs in the first
1.8. Yeah, <come on>. Spoiler alert. 1.8 gig is what you're looking at roughly for a decent 720p rip. Yeah. I know this because I'm a journalist and I do my research and just double-check. So
that sounds about
it. But I'm sure the frame rate is nice and high, everything else, so that it does the 720p.
Million gigs. In a day,
it's a lot of data.
Sure.
Anyway,
the greatest marketing.
Mostly probably in the US, that it doesn't really matter, because let's face it, the internet lives there. It's all really, really close. I must tell you, I recently switched to LTE at home, and man, it's like, what a difference.
Do you sign it to your contract? Oh, is it journal?
No, I'm just testing it.
Yeah. I thought of doing it, but the 2-year contract is just silly. The way prices are coming down, you have to lock yourself into $2,000 a month. And it'll be a great service.
What cap is that?
100 gigs.
Yeah, so I'm on 100 gig fast at the moment, which is LTE Advanced. I don't have the hardware yet for the LTE Advanced, but on the normal LTE hardware, I'm getting between 16 and 20 megabits per second, clean as the driven
stuff. We use it at the office, it's great.
And unbelievably low pings.
Yeah.
I'm feeling quite supported at the moment. I'll be honest with you, I had to adjust my usage patterns quite a bit in order to fit into under 100 gigs worth of consumption a month. So no Netflix, no Hulu, no fiddling around or anything like that. Really limiting a lot of the other Creative Commons downloading that I do at home. So, and interesting, I figured out that my kids can smash through about 5 gigs of YouTube in a weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Like without cracking a sweat, dude. Yeah.
Kids suddenly watch YouTube these days.
Suddenly, when you've got a 20 megabit home internet connection, YouTube magically adjusts
everything
the quality to high def, right? Yeah. And suddenly starts milling through your content. And I'm sorry, they don't need to watch Stampy Long Nose.
You do know the kids don't care.
YouTube videos. No, for sure. They're like, wow, Stampy's really clear today, Dad. I'm like, give me your iPad, boy. So crank it down a couple of levels. Which are interesting. Something I wanted to chat about lastly, just to kind of round things out, I think you know, before we get into the one reader or listener question that we've had for the week, is just to chat about the rise of native advertising. And it's something we've been chatting about just recently, the fact that do you think that banner advertising is on its way out? I've seen so many posts on Medium from a number of people saying that, in their opinion, native advertising is the future. And I do think...
But remember, that's going to be native's revenue stream of choice is native advertising. So it would make sense that on native they talk about native advertising. On Medium they talk about native advertising.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that... No. I'm talking about independent commentators inside the industry, talking about the fact that the industry is shifting from a place where banners and CPM and that kind of stuff is not really all that important.
But carefully placed...
Higher value stuff.
In the form of
sponsored editorial and advertorial is going to be what makes the internet go around in the future.
Ev did a big post on this. It's well worth looking up and reading. And he was talking about the death of kind of impressions and that kind of thing. And their medium at metric TTR, total time reading. And they said that's not even where they want to be, but they're trying to look at it completely differently. So they want to have a longer, deeper experience as opposed to trying to shove an impression in people's faces.
As a publisher, it's been quite interesting to have this discussion with a bunch of people, because so many people have said, as a publisher, don't you feel like you're selling out by putting native advertising on your site and stuff like that? And I've gone, no, actually, the interesting thing for me is we fight the CPM battle day in, day out, right? Yeah. And it's, you have no idea until you've actually been in a publisher's shoes where you're blowing a ton of money every single month on a team that creates amazing content, and then somebody coming to you and saying, well, you guys aren't worth more than like a couple of rand per 1,000 impressions you create. It's like they rip your heart out and they stomp on it, which is interesting because they're well prepared to pay for native advertising, big money, really, really good money. The CPMs are exponentially higher on native advertising, and the interesting thing is that's not measured by any way, mean, or form on the total page impressions on your site. Somebody will pay you money based on the number of impressions your site does in exchange for an opportunity for somebody to read a piece of content they've placed on your site.
Same way podcasts started monetizing in the States.
Yeah.
They commanded a much higher cost per thousand. But I think don't understate how hectic that CPM problem is. I mean, 250 Rand CPM, if my math is correct, is 25 cents per impression, or 2.5 cents, one of the two.
Yeah. And bearing in mind, when we talk cents, we're talking South African cents. And the other interesting thing is South Africa is an anomaly when it comes to this. Our CPMs are exponentially higher in South Africa than what they are anywhere else in the world.
Google CPMs are like a dollar or two.
And this is the thing. So, I mean, it's 250 Rand versus 12 or 13 Rand CPM if you're getting a good Google rate right now. So, I mean, yeah.
So I think here's where native advertising is coming in. It's trying to answer a fundamental problem of the internet, is that the internet converts at 1% if you're lucky.
Yeah.
Like, the internet has just proven time and time again that outside of the anomalies, outside of viral, and I put big inverted commas around that,
yeah,
it is a terrible medium for getting people to actually do something.
It's because of scale. It's because of like sheer onslaught of information and the absolute ubiquity and glut of content that's on the internet right now. Whereas, I mean, the interesting thing is print has still got a massive CPM by comparison.
Yeah.
And as a print publisher, I will tell you the following, right? Print is not as expensive as print publishers make it out to be. Believe me, it's expensive. It's definitely, without a doubt, more expensive than online. But it's not.
No, but they're playing the premium costing game.
Anyway, but I mean, it's really, really interesting. I frankly don't have a problem with it. At the end of the day, my line on it at the moment, when people ask me for my opinion on it, is it's the same as an advert. Right, a piece of native advertising on my site is very clearly marked as this happens to be words and pictures in an article format, but somebody paid for it and they wrote the words. It wasn't written by my editorial team. It is a sponsored post or a piece of advertising. How is that any different from a banner?
How is it any different from a live read on a radio station?
Exactly.
There's no difference. I think it's all going to come
down
to...
Except live reads generally aren't marked as live reads, which is interesting. You have to be able to pick up the difference in the DJ's voice.
The tone as they start to read. Yes. Yeah. I think it's just, you know, advertising at the end of the day, if you look at the fundamentals, is how can we get people to commit an action or buy a product? And the internet is just starting to fiddle around with better ways to do that because the current ways aren't working as well.
The reason I'm a big fan of it is because I felt for the longest time, like I say, it's demoralizing being anything but that publisher. You know, it tears your heart out, dude. It tears your heart out if somebody's offering you a dollar for a 1,000-page imprint. You can't survive. I mean, you just there's no way you can do a decent job of being a publisher if that's the reality.
Not a scaled publisher with a journalist's staff.
And I know how expensive it is because I have one of the biggest editorial staff compliments. There we go. One of the biggest editorial staff compliments for a site of this size. But it's because we have a bigger vision for it and we've invested in it. But the reality is I'm hugely all for like higher CPMs. And if native advertising is the way to do that, rare. Please mark your content as a sponsored or an advertorial if you're going to do it. So at least you keep the industry a little cleaner.
Well, the way other mediums are going, and this is tricky for you being a journalist, is you probably couldn't do this, but other mediums are going on kind of paid for performance contracts. So if you look at the insurance industry and Google AdWords and any kind of lead generation mechanic, where companies are starting to move towards is, okay, there will be a media budget, there will be a fee on the media, and then you will pay us 50 Rand per lead we generate and 200 Rand per sale we generate.
Absolutely.
And everything else is, you know, that's how we make our money.
Can I tell you what the problem with that kind of model is? And we got burnt so badly with this model right in the beginning.
Well, you can't do that as a journalist.
No, you can. You can absolutely do CPC campaigns to kind of say every time someone clicks on your banner, therefore a lead is generated, all right, you will pay us X, okay? And then it's normal advertising, right? And if that results in a sale, you'll pay us more. Ad agencies can be bastards, all right, and so can brands. So, you know, there's a very clear delineation between a CPC and a CPM campaign. A CPC campaign is designed to specifically elicit a call to action, all right? All right. Samsung Galaxy S6, 500 Rand off, click here now to buy. That's a CPC campaign. A CPM campaign is designed to build brand and
tell a story and all that kind of stuff.
So therefore, cheaper per thousand, governed by a completely different metric, right? You only get paid when somebody clicks on the banner in a CPC, and in a CPM campaign, it's number of times the banner is shown to someone. And we got burnt really badly in the beginning, where we got offered a fantastically high CPC. All right, it was really, really attractive per click. The problem was the creative we were delivered was all about brand, not designed to create a call to action at all. So what happened was we showed hundreds of thousands of impressions of this ad and we didn't get paid because the creative was not designed to create a click. So again, you need to be very, very clear on it. We won't get involved with the CPC stuff because you have no control over the creative. Now, the interesting thing with native advertising, and this is where it comes full circle, for us, we do have an influence on whether or not it creates the kind of response the client can. Because what we're doing is while we're...
Yeah, but where's the line of ethics there?
No. The line of ethics is, right, simply saying to your client, all right, we know our audience, right, they are these people, making sure that they are well-versed in who your audience is and who they're speaking to. So first and foremost, making sure that the advertiser, be it native or banner advertising, knows who the reader of your site is, so that they know whether to spend money with you or not, right? It's very easy to take the money, but it's better taking the money and knowing that the advertiser is going to get good value from it because he'll come back and spend more. Maybe take less in the beginning, but long-term money is way better. That's the first thing. Second thing, also just saying, historically, the kinds of things that have worked well on the site are these, all right? And when you see them making a blatantly wrong move, like we had a piece of native advertising come onto HTXT this week, but it was so badly written, there weren't even links in the copy. You go, that's fantastic. You're paying top dollar for native advertising on my website, all right? And A, the copy's badly written, but let's just assume it was really well written, all right? At the end of it, the reader can't go anywhere or do anything or deliver any value to you because you didn't put any links in the copy. You didn't even put a call to action right at the end. So it's about saying that kind of thing and saying, dear Mr. Advertiser, we really appreciate your money, but this is how you get the most out of our site. There you go. Do your thing. All right, and very, very clearly not having your editorial people involved in that conversation. They must make content, and the commercial side of the business must guide the advertising getting best value. But anyway.
Look, I think it's good to play around with. The internet does need to invent more performance-based metrics and performance mediums.
Hey, first and foremost, the internet needs higher CPMs. Let's do that so that publishers can create quality content.
It's
that would be nice.
Before that, the internet needs to convert more. You know, I sit there with my team at For Good, and do you know how hard it is to describe to people that when they get when the site's converting at 3%, that's actually really good?
Yeah, absolutely. It's
completely counterintuitive, and I don't like that about the
internet. It's 200% better than what it should be.
Yeah.
At 3%, it's 200%. You are performing 200% above par.
That's
horrible, right?
I don't dig it.
Anywho. Okay, cool. Let's quickly round out with something very, very fast. And it was a listener that popped us a tweet earlier this week to just say some advice on where to start in terms of podcasting. So,
Hemus Lakala.
Andy, you're my witness. We don't run the most highly sophisticated setup over here. So what's currently happening is we have a desk. It looks really, really big, but it's only got a couple of channels on it that's working. It goes into a little box that converts an analog signal into a digital signal and plugs into my Mac over USB. We recorded a piece of software called Audio Hijack Pro, which is available from a company called Rogue Amoeba. You can download the demo and play with it if you want. It's recorded in as high quality as possible, then edited in another piece of software from Rogue Amoeba called Fission, then dumped into GarageBand, and GarageBand is what we use to just line up our jingles on either side. We use
top
a free,
and tail.
Exactly. We use a free piece of software called Levelator, which literally takes an audio
out.
File. No, well, it
normalizes.
It normalizes. Yeah. So what it does is, like Andy actually is louder than me right now. Can you believe it? But I can pick it up on the headphones. But what happens is it makes him the same volume as me and makes sure that the audio just sounds really nice and rounded and clean.
It'll also take out, big pops.
Absolutely. That
like
was a
those.
Big pop. And then lastly, we stick it into iTunes to add some meta to it, and we use a piece of software called Blueberry, which is actually a media hosting thing, but it's also a plugin set for WordPress that allows you to very easily just drag a file in, type in the meta, hit go, and it goes, right?
So do you publish to iTunes?
So right now, Blueberry doesn't publish to... No, okay, so what happens is...
It's an RSS.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So you've got to make sure that your feed's correct. And Blueberry essentially curates our feed and makes sure that all the meta and everything else is great. That sounded really complex, didn't it? Okay.
No, you know, it's. I wouldn't say it's the easiest thing, but there's plenty of how-tos on the internet. And you've just given the name of every software program you need. Publishing to iTunes is usually the most complicated, I hear.
It's about getting your feed right, yeah. Getting your site right so that it publishes the correct RSS feed, and then iTunes will do its thing from then onwards. What's way easier, though, and I mean, this is the thing. It's only come along in the past couple of years. Thank you, Google.
Good mics, by the way. You forgot that.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, you really need good mics.
I cannot understate the importance of getting a high-quality source right at the beginning, because you can always edit and fiddle and do some cool stuff in post. But if the source is really, really crap, it's the same as video. You can't turn a 410p thing, you know, piece of content into 1080p or 4K. You just can't. It's like physically impossible. It's record in as raw a format as possible. But here's the thing. The biggest shortcut to doing all of this is Google Hangouts, man. Get yourself a good USB mic, right? A good set of headphones. And if your Mac or your PC doesn't have a good webcam, go and get one of the Creative Labs high def ones, because they've got great low light performance, and start fiddling around with Hangouts. Hangouts does 98% of this work for you.
Yeah.
So it records, it publishes, it streams, it does amazing.
It also allows you to output the end product to YouTube.
Exactly, and I was going to say this is this is the next big thing is use YouTube more often. Right? We use historically iTunes and an RSS feed and stuff like that because we started podcasting in an era where that was the norm. Okay. Now, what has happened is you build up your core fan base, and that's it. And that's the core fan base becomes used to receiving your content in a specific way. All right. But these days, YouTube is actually the preferred way for doing all of that kind of stuff. So, I would really encourage you to start playing with YouTube and Hangouts, because it makes it so ridiculously simple. I was actually helping somebody out with a setup 2 weeks ago, and that's exactly what we ended up doing. We got them good kit, we hooked it all together, and of course the important thing with Hangouts is to make sure you've got a killer quick internet connection, and LTE is a great way to do that, because you're actually not shipping a huge volume of data, but you need really, really fast bandwidth. Yeah. And it's ironic that wireless is actually the fastest way of doing that today. You can't do it with a wired connection. Mm. Well, you can, but you have to be zoned for fiber and wait nine years. Yeah. And
the only thing I'd add to that is, you know, from an international and local perspective, if you look at the US, podcasts feel like they really are starting to take off now. There's a podcast you should listen to called Startup, which is a podcast about starting up a company, a podcast company.
Fantastic.
So it kind of answers your question.
You literally cannot make that up. It's amazing. It's one of the best things.
It's very meta. And then there's another one. It was called Serial, and that kind of broke all records in terms of listenership. And
yeah, it was
the
mad.
Reason these things are starting to break all these records and really become a media consumption stream of choice is the quality. The quality and the production value. It took them, I stand corrected, but it took them, I think, a year to make Serial.
Wow.
A full year, and it's a 12-episode podcast.
That's mad. Yeah, look, I mean, and there's some interesting stuff. Go look around on YouTube. A lot of these YouTube video series and stuff like that are also, like, you'll be surprised. It's not just someone sitting in their bedroom playing an acoustic guitar in a weird hat.
There's a lot of work that goes into it.
There's a lot of, like,
and then from a local perspective,
actors and stuff.
I mean, just, you know, my usual little cold splashy reality. Just make sure it's something you're super passionate about, because the South African audiences are not huge.
Yeah.
You can get a core base of fans. The show has one.
Yeah.
It's hard to monetize. It's usually better as part of a bigger kind of media offering.
It needs to be. It is best positioned as a value add to something else.
Correct.
As opposed to a core revenue stream. At least that's been our
it's
our
just the audiences are low. I mean, I think, you know.
And do not underestimate the sway you have in terms of quality. Do not, like Andy says, do not expect the fact that you are going to get a gigantic audience. That's the bottom line. Unless you're doing something very general and mainstream and endorsed by a celebrity and possibly are a celebrity doing it, you are not going to get the scale. But if you do a good job and you offer value, you will get an extremely loyal listener base, and that's where it's at.
And then, you know, I'm a candid guy, so I always found this interesting. You know, cliffcentral.com released quite a few stats as they were going. And I think, geez, it was back at the last Tech for Africa, they said 2 million downloads of shows, which is an enormous number. But then you will find that this show beats any Cliff Central show on the iTunes charts by far. And the only thing I can do to reconcile that in my head is that people who are listening to Cliff Central are listening to it like radio. So they're streaming it in their car.
But it's also quite transient. They're like in and out of it and stuff like that. I think that...
But this show has... Looking at the stats... For the last year, this show has been above Cliff Central on the iTunes charts. And that, I think, is because there is a core audience that listens to this show, but there's a smaller core audience listening to podcasts in the on-demand variety than there is potentially listening to streaming radio.
I think so, possibly. I mean, you know, we also find we get great contributions from Stitcher and stuff like that that doesn't show up in iTunes, which is quite... Anyway, let's move on to Picks of the Week, because I actually need to dash. Andy, you have two Picks of the Week this week.
I do. So why don't you go first? I'm going to set up a little tweet so that I can show you what my pick of the week is doing.
So my pick is something we alluded to a little bit earlier. Everybody knows I'm kind of a fan of wearables and specifically fitness trackers. I've been waiting for this one for a while because it does a whole bunch of things that I've been wanting out of a combination wearable fitness tracker for a while. It's called the Garmin Vivo Active. Garmin's been getting unbelievably strong in terms of the devices they're bringing to market for the kind of more entry-level market. They've had brilliant high-end trackers and fitness computers and stuff like that for prosumer and professional athletes, but that bottom end, that Nike Fuel Band market has been missing. They're great. Approach to the market now is really understanding where that mid-level lies, and it's somewhere between the stuff that the Fuel Band, Fitbit, Jawbone kind of spaces and the high-end stuff. The product I've got at the moment, which is the Garmin Vivo Active, is a great example of that, in that it has all the accelerometers and stuff built in. It's got a built-in GPS, so this is great for outdoor activity, but it supports running, it supports cycling, it supports swimming. And this is really important. It's like a vital part of that whole equation.
What? You mean it can have water?
Things get wet, things get sweat on. This has got a 50-meter depth rating on it, which doesn't mean you're going to dive with it, but at the same time, because, I mean, if you fall,
I'd like to test that, though.
If you fall off a water ski at high speed, you might well end up putting water into this device because it's all about the amount of pressure it can take, but 50 meters is fine. So you can, very importantly, you can shower with this device, but it also means you can swim with it, all right? And that's really cool. All of the stuff that I loved about the TomTom, the built-in GPS, the fact that it was multi-sport, the fact that I could swim with it, the fact that it had a lap counter built in is here. But then at the same time, this does a couple of things more, in that this is a wearable in the sense that it's not just wearable, but it your notifications, your tweets, your WhatsApps, your Facebooks, your emails, your calls, all of that kind of stuff is displayed on it. There's a fair amount of interaction that goes on with the phone. That's really cool. Very customizable in terms of like watch faces, and you can look at your diary on it and that kind of stuff. Very thin, looks like a pretty middle of the road, I'll be honest. Android wearable, all right.
Kind of harks, the sexiest thing, but
kind of harks back to the older generation Sony smartwatch.
It's
a very similar look. It's got two buttons on it, one that's the on off and backlight button, and another one that takes you through some of the options. But the one thing it is missing, and this I'm kind of sad about, is it doesn't have the built in heart rate monitoring that the Charge HR and the TomTom has. So it's a, you know, it seems like this is the closest anybody has gotten to developing the device that one wants ultimately as a as somebody like me that's, that that trains really, really hard, but you're still not a professional, and has some needs in terms of a smartwatch. But it also then takes that little step back in that it doesn't have the built-in heart rate monitoring, and that makes me kind of sad. So, but look, nonetheless, it should be in the market for somewhere between $3,000 and $3,500, so it's not going to break the bank. It also it supports full Ant Plus, so you have the ability to hook it up.
Money bags.
Go and look at how much these things cost these days. It's ridiculous.
The reason I was looking at the Charge HR, the Fitbit one, was I think it's about $2,000.
Yeah, and then if you buy it on Discovery and your Vitality, they will give you 750 rand of your own money back. Because I'll give you 750 bucks of your MSA back, and I'm like, excuse me, hang on. Who's really? Anyway. So
it's a backhanded feature, if there ever was one.
I'm going to put it through its paces over the next couple of weeks, and I will report back. But so far, so good. I'm really enjoying it, and it's going to be... It's going to be nice to be able to not have to take my wearable off when I get in the shower or when I swim. Andy, your picks.
Cool.
Quick.
Okay. First of all, I pick on Google. Bastards. No, I guess it's very quick, but and I've started reading this. This seems to be happening globally. Google Chrome does some mad, nasty, evil, sorcery stuff with my Mac battery. It is killing my Mac battery. And I'll give you a very good example. Sitting here during this podcast, it said 2 hours 30 remaining on the battery. I loaded up the Verge Apple Watch article. It sat in the background. My battery went down to 38 minutes over a period of time of, say, 10 minutes.
That's mad. I mean, I look at my dock right now. I'm not using Chrome. I stopped using it a while back because
it is
killing
battery.
I can't explain it. I cannot tell you why. I'm not that much of a techie that's gone and analyzed it, and I haven't had the chance to, frankly, read all of the reports. But I can tell you this. My battery life is crap when I'm using Chrome. If I'm using Safari, it's not.
I don't know. It makes me mad because it really is a nice browser. And the only reason I can't use Safari or don't want to use Safari is that it doesn't have the favicons in the browser tabs. So when you have 10, 15 browser tabs open, it's almost impossible to see what's what because you don't have those little icons. And it's really, really irritating. Okay, so away from negativity and onto positivity. This seems to have passed a couple of people by. But there is a little function on the Twitter apps called View Tweet Activity. Now, I know this is an audio podcast, but I'm going to pass it to Brett so he can see.
Yeah.
And what it does is that it shows you the performance of your tweets in real time. So you sit there and you watch it.
53, 54. So these are people that are actually looking at...
So, again, I need to figure that out, but basically that is impressions, which means it's been placed into someone's Twitter feed. I gather that means that they're looking at Twitter at the same time. There was an engagement. Someone just clicked to view the tweet details. You'll
what
see
tweet
replies.
Was this?
The one I just tweeted now about the view tweet activity. It's very meta. Live experience. And so, A, it's real time and it's very cool. And B, I think you're going to get a shock at how few people have a chance of actually seeing each tweet.
Yeah, it's something that we're looking into a lot because, again, like speaking more in terms of, to round things out again, the native advertising stuff, a big part of that is the social stuff. It's pushing stuff up on Twitter and Facebook and other social channels. It'll be interesting to see. What astounds me about this is not available in the native Twitter desktop apps. And this
it's an experiment. They'll experiment with the apps first because most of their traffic will be there.
But I'm talking about native Twitter applications built for desktop platforms. I find it very exciting.
I think do some experiments. You're going to see that your tweet has a chance of being seen by 3-5% of your audience, which means 1% of 3-5% will do anything with it. That is a very, very small number.
Okay, so how do you use it again? Just show me.
So on the you go to the tweet, you expand the details of the tweet.
All right.
Of your tweet. It has to be your tweet.
Okay.
You go to the bottom and you click View Tweet Activity. It's a very cool tool to play around with.
Okay. Well, I think it's there because you can go.
So far, 87 impressions on the tweet I did about a minute ago.
87 impressions.
Pretty low considering there's 6,000 followers that it's meant to get to.
Absolutely. So what you can do actually is you can do this in the desktop version.
Because 91.
View tweet details and then it's a little more thing. Let's just see, can you? No, it's not in real time.
I think they're just experimenting with it.
Interesting.
But anyway, it gives you very, very cool stuff.
I'd keep an eye out on the desktop version because I think it'll happen soon.
That's it.
Okay, so there we go. Episode 325 of the ZA Tech Show. Andy, thanks for coming to hang out.
Absolutely.
Your first couple of days back from the cave.
I just got a link click.
A link click, wow.
All live.
Look at you, man.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to be above ground, not jet lagged anymore, and need to hit the mountain bike in preparation for Bergen Bush.
Indeed. And then, as we discussed earlier, Sohosan's...
maybe.
I'm a Shova Classic directly thereafter. We'll get you on a road bike soon. So that's it, guys. Thanks for hanging out and listening to the podcast. As always, if you want to get in touch with us, Twitter, Facebook, and on the site, we now live at htxt.co.za/ZATS. All of our details are there if you want to get in contact with us. Please do so. Until next week, take care. Cheers. Wow, 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 wow.